Good afternoon, everyone, and I will call the Tuesday, September 21st, 2010 meeting of the Senate Commerce and Workforce Development Committee to order. We will be joined, I think, in the next hour or so by another one of our members. Senator Floyd Przanski is excused today because he is actually working at his full-time day job. Since it's been a little while since we've met, I'll ask the members to introduce themselves.
Senator Chris Telfer from District 27, sunny Central Oregon.
And I am the chair of the, and Senator Telfer's the vice chair of the committee. I am the chair of the committee, Senator Diane Rosenbaum, and my district is Senate District 21, which is Southeast Portland, where I live, Northeast Portland, which is close to where I live, and then a little of Clackamas County, extending as far south as Milwaukee. And Senator?
And I'm Senator Rod Monroe, District 24, and when you're in Diane's district and you hit a bit east, you end up in my district. And so we represent, both of us represent portions of Portland. I also represent Happy Valley as well.
Teresa, do you want to introduce yourself to the whole world out in internet land?
Internet land, TV land, and those in the room. I'm Teresa Van Winkle. I am the administrator for this fine committee. Welcome. And Sue Hampton over on the side is the assistant for today.
Great. Thank you, Sue, for helping us out. So, members, we have a really full agenda today, and the first part of it, I sort of was playing with titles and came up with the title, The Good News. And so Teresa and I were saying this committee is the committee where you deliver good news. If you want to deliver bad news, there's other committees down on the House side of the building. Go there with the bad news. So, but no, truly, we called it the good news because there really are a lot of exciting things going on, even in these tough economic times, both with training programs such as we're about to hear about and also employers starting to hire and expand, and that really is a hopeful sign. So I think that's kind of the tone that we want to strike for the first part of the meeting. And we're very pleased to have as our first witness Dr. Chris Maples, who's here from the Oregon Institute of Technology to tell us about their wonderful renewable energy engineering training program, which I had the opportunity to visit. And members, if you haven't been out there, you really should, because it is very, very impressive and an incredible thing to have in our state. So welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Telfer, Senator Monroe, and members of the audience. I really appreciate the chance to be here. Oregon Tech is a good news university, so I think I'm in the right place here, it sounds like, for the most part. What I want to take you through, and this is not to be death by PowerPoint, so please jump in with questions or comments or anything at any point in time. Don't let the PowerPoint deter you from doing that. I want to tell you a little bit about Oregon Tech, a little bit about our students, a little bit about our history and our present and our future in these high-tech green sectors. It's not just renewable energy engineering, but we've been doing some things along these lines for quite some time now. Plans for our continued growth and development of Oregon's green high-tech economy, and then hopefully leave a little bit of time for questions or comments at the end of that all. I put this slide up here as Oregon Tech's focus because what you see is students, and what you see is students doing hands-on type of learning. As a four-year university in the Oregon University System, we are big into the educational component, and by education here, I mean we teach our students the fundamental theoretical underpinnings of all of these things that they do in engineering and the allied health sectors. They are then able to go off, and by having these hands-on experiences, they're able to apply those theoretical and fundamental understandings and basics to real-world situations. We're very problem-solving oriented. We're very classroom-oriented. We focus on the undergraduate teaching environment primarily. We have a fairly new mission statement that has gone through lots and lots and lots of groups on campus and with interested stakeholders outside of the campus. The key to walk away from here is the applied degree programs in the engineering technologies, health technologies, management, and the intimate hands-on learning environment that focuses on the application of theory to practice. I think that's the main thing to walk away from. In some respects, we offer very much a specialized, almost private school type of education at a public school price. And it's a real deal and quite an opportunity. And one of the reasons, frankly, I'm in public education is because of the totally egalitarian nature of public ed. People ought to have the opportunity. And Oregonians ought to have the opportunity to be able to educate themselves in these areas and then go on and do well in jobs. And we are pretty good in that respect as well. We have become very much a transfer university in many respects. We have a number of students who transfer in to our programs. And in fact, we are about 65% transfer students who come to us, either having taken their first year or two at a community college, or literally walking in with a four-year degree or a graduate degree from somewhere else and realizing that really what they want to do is have more of a workable degree that they can apply in a high-tech sector in this current economy. I mean, we have a number of people who have done that. And that transition has occurred over the past 6 years or so and continues. It is so important to us that what we have done is very recently done some restructuring in our registrar's department and have assigned a person specifically to work on transfers, and not just to get transfers on the books, but to work with the community colleges in particular in this state to make sure that the students that are transferring in from the community college are being successful. The goal is for the students to be successful. And success for us is graduating with a degree in hand. That's a critical aspect of what we do. Most people don't know where we are. We started in 1947. Main campus is in Klamath Falls. We have four Portland locations, Portland area locations. We have one location in LeGrand, which is a nice public-private partnership that we do with Eastern Oregon University and the ODS for dental hygiene. And then we have one in Seattle. We have 100 Boeing students, where we have a public-private partnership with Boeing, teaching operations management and some certificate programs in composite materials and other things that Boeing engineers want and need.
Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Yes, sir.
Your Boeing school, is there any difference in tuition for out-of-state versus the schools that are in Oregon?
We have a separate negotiated rate with Boeing that is considerably higher than in-state tuition. And in fact, some of the proceeds from that program help support some of the things that we do here in Oregon.
That's critical, Madam Chair. You know, we all love our friends up in Washington, but we have serious financial problems.
You bet.
At every level of education in this state, and so I would hate to see us going the other direction and basically outsourcing some of our education dollars.
I completely agree with you. That one actually makes money for us, and we funnel it back into programs here in Oregon.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you for the question. That's a good clarification to make. Our success measures really are tied to professional growth. I have to admit, by background, I'm a geologist and paleontologist, and long before BP's issues in the Gulf, I used the example of no self-respecting geologist would drill a hole in the ground and just pump oil out and have it spew everywhere and call it successful. We have to have a pipeline of where students go and what they do. And so we are very, very, very committed to making sure that there is a market out there that the students will be able to go into. So our enrollment has gone up. It will go up again this year. I'm not sure how much, but it will go up again this year. We will cross the 4,000 number in terms of total number of students that we have this year. Even this year, even in this economic climate, 92% of our graduates find a job or are in a graduate or professional program. And of that, 71% are in very, very closely related fields to what they do. The average starting salary of our graduates is $55,000 a year, and that's not cherry-picking specific things. That is everything across the board. I like to think that we are educating the middle class and getting people into tax-paying situations as quickly as possible. And we've been very successful at that. The Klamath Falls area has a history of renewable energy, and in fact, the current site of the campus was picked because it was said that Winston Pervine, the first president of the university, noticed that snow melted there much earlier in the spring than a lot of other places, and therefore there had to be some geothermal. And sure enough, there has been. And so we've had geothermal working on the campus, primarily melting snow and using it for heat, for five decades now. In very recent years, what we have done is we have put on board a small geothermal electric converter where we are using some of the geothermal heat. It's about 200 degree water that we volatilize a separate fluid and then use some of that to actually generate some electricity for the campus. We have a very large power plant that will be going online in 2012. We drilled a well approximately a mile deep. We still have about 200 degree water, but the amount of water is a tremendous amount, and we're going to be able to generate about anywhere from 40 to 60% of our campus needs for electricity, depending on peak utilization. We will also use that as a teaching, learning, operating environment for our students. They'll be able to see exactly how this works. And I have asked for plans to include literally slots that that companies can put smaller geothermal electric converters in and out of and try different designs given a set of circumstances that they know about and compare them with other designs. Not only will that be able to be used as a test bed for those companies and for their own development, but it provides a really nice opportunity for our students to learn and learn a lot of different types of geothermal options here. We have gotten into sustainability in a big way. I like to say we walk the talk of sustainability to the best of our ability to do so. Our goal is to really just make this happen for our students and to work closely with the Klamath Falls community in doing so as well. We have two full-time staff now dedicated to green accountability, and we're a charter member of the STARS program, which is a sustainability tracking and rating system. It's one thing to say you're going to do it. It's really important, in my estimation, to actually have some metrics, hit those metrics, see how you're doing, and decide if it's worthwhile, and really try to make this work and have the students understand that it's really about productivity and deliverable results. Our renewable energy engineering degree was the first of its kind in the country. There are a couple of universities now, I'm told, that are trying to come along with something similar. It now has the highest enrollment of any of our majors. It has well over 200 students enrolled. We had 100% graduate job success last year, and that N is now up to about 26 or thereabouts, so that was the number of students who have graduated. We will offer an MS degree in 2011. This has really picked up and gotten us a lot of national prominence and recognition. This has been really important. And what we are doing, and it's, I don't want to say it's sneaky, but it's a little bit tricky. We are teaching students the fundamentals of mechanical and electrical engineering and having them apply those fundamentals and what they learn to all types of renewable energy situations and problems. So there are a lot of students in there who would never take mechanical and electrical engineering, but they're going to learn everything about mechanical and electrical engineering because they can work on these renewable energy problems. And that becomes part of the hallmark of what we do. Again, we're very problem-oriented, internship, externship-oriented, working specifically with industries. Every one of our departments and programs has an industry advisory council. And we listen to what they want, and we deliver what they want. And we adjust our curriculum accordingly. And we do so across the state. And you see the types of jobs that a lot of our students are in, and that's just some examples. This is overwhelming. You have a copy in front of you. I just thought you'd like to see a flavor for the types of prospective employers that have interviewed and or hired our students in renewable energy engineering in the past couple of years. And this is not a comprehensive list. The list is much larger than this.
And Dr. Maples, I don't want to interrupt the flow of thought here, but I had an opportunity to meet with the head of government relations at Intel recently,
yes.
And she came out of a higher education background. I think that was her job at Intel previously. She was telling me that they still can't find not only not Oregonians, but U.S. citizens to fill all of the specialized engineering jobs that they need to hire for, that they've been steadily hiring people all through the recession.
Right.
And so, I mean, clearly, I think some of the people that you're turning out would be people, and I see Intel's on that list.
Yes, they are.
But it's just, I mean, it's amazing that even in this economy, there are qualifications that we just aren't producing enough people from schools in Oregon or the U.S. to do those jobs.
And you bring up a very interesting point. Philosophically, what we are doing is we are truly focusing on recruiting and educating Oregonians first. That's our goal. I feel like the high-tech sector, the allied health sector, and the fact that we're a public university, we owe it to the people of the state first. And so that's been our focus. We have gone out of state a little bit, but it's not a focus. What my goal is to have a wonderfully successful program like renewable energy engineering drive a lot of out-of-state and international traffic. And so one of the things I get to do, because we're a small school, is I actually personally sign every one of the letters that a student is admitted to Oregon Tech. And so I get to see where all these letters go, and they are going to just about every state in the union. It is amazing. I mean, the amount of out-of-state traffic that is driven largely by renewable energy engineering is phenomenal. It is amazing. Other areas where we have been involved, the Oregon Renewable Energy Center, which promotes energy conservation and renewable energy use through applied research and education programs. The GeoHeat Center, which is well-known nationally and internationally for technical support for geothermal development. And what they're working on now is less high temperature and a lot more shallow, low-temperature heat pump type of applications, which have much, much broader appeal. We have an OIT Sustainability Committee. We have an Environmental Science and Sustainability Technologies, and that is really pushing and taking off. And we have a potential collaboration with the environmental science area going with Southern Oregon University in their environmental studies. And we work locally with Klamath Sustainable Communities, among other local groups that we work with. And again, looking for areas where education and community activities can come together. Right now, in sustainability and green technologies, economies are really, and efficiencies are really the low-hanging fruit, but we're going to be out of that soon. And at that point, it's going to be technological breakthroughs, and it's our goal to have a number of our graduates help lead those technological breakthroughs by understanding what is needed in a broad array of different types of renewable energy areas. The other good news here is that we have gotten federal grants to support some of this green job education. The U.S. Department of Energy has just given us a strategic training and education in power systems grant, $2.5 million that will hire 5 new faculty, produce some new labs for us, change our curriculum, get some additional industry engagement, and have some internships. This is really a big deal for us. This is a big grant for us and a really important one. Bob Bass and Mateo Aboy and all of the faculty that have been involved in renewable energy engineering at OIT have been stellar in this, as has Lita Culligan. U.S. Department of Labor grant, we have a state energy sector partnership, again, for grant-supported internships in the energy sector. We have 2 new offices to support these industry partnerships. One is an Office of Strategic Partnership, and the other one is an Office of Innovation and Technology Transfer. One of our renewable energy engineering faculty members has taken has studied enough on his own to pass the bar equivalent for filing patents with the U.S. Patent Office. He has the license to do that. He will file 10 gratis per year for us, for our students and our industry partners. And one of the things that we're doing is we're already working that into the curriculum in some of our classes, where students, instead of writing up the standard lab report at the end of it all, will write up a report as though they were filing for intellectual property. In applying these different types of engineering solutions to different problems, some of our groups of students come up with unique solutions, and some of those potentially have some intellectual property value. And I think it's really important to give those students the recognition and understanding that they can then take that and turn that into an economic engine, and hopefully for Oregon. And hopefully they'll stay here when they do those kinds of things.
So could I just ask you, if these patents then produce revenue, mm-hmm. and these are inventions that were developed when they were students
Correct.
At OIT,
Correct.
Who gets the money?
We'll share. We'll do a sharing partnership. I mean, we will do a sharing arrangement.
Between them and
us and the industry and however it works out. I mean, we'll do a sharing arrangement. One of the things I've done in a past life is I've overseen a tech transfer office. I did it in Reno, Nevada, for a place called Desert Research Institute, and I oversaw a tech transfer office that was joint with University of Nevada, Reno. And one of the things that we did there was we set up a deal where faculty, in order to get them to think about that more as a way of producing and sharing intellectual value in the research that they did, we had a deal set for faculty where faculty got 60% net returned to them on any of the revenue that was done. It's probably one of the best deals in the country. So you can incentivize people in a sharing mode, and everybody wins in that regard. And we'll head down that line. A lot of this has boiled down to recognition and kudos for us, and for Oregon generally. We've been named as a top 10 green college program, primarily because of that renewable energy engineering degree. By Wise Choice, we were listed as one of the 6 best land surveying schools in the U.S. by EHOW, and EHOW is a U.K. Company. We've been in geomatics and land surveying traditionally for many years and are extremely well known in that field nationally. We were noted in Forbes as one of the top 600 colleges and universities in the U.S., and that may not sound like a lot, but there are about 4,000 colleges and universities that they evaluated, so that puts us in the top 15%, which is pretty good. There were a lot of schools not on that list. We were ranked number 7th recently in Western U.S. colleges in U.S. News and World Report. And a couple of the things that I'm very proud of is that we were number 2 in the peer assessment there, only behind the Air Force Academy, and number 3 in the publics, behind the Air Force Academy again and the Cal Maritime Academy. We're number 42 in the engineering program nationally in bachelor's and master's institutions, and that puts us tied with some pretty good schools, including Boise State. And we were tied for the 15th best public university on that list when you weed out the private universities. And of those 15 public universities, the majority of them are often military-type academies and specialty academies. What we are doing is taking our 4 campuses that we have in the Portland metro area and consolidating them into the former InFocus building right along I-5 in Wilsonville. There's 131,000 square feet of Class A office space, more than 500 parking spots, 6 acres. The industries around there include Xerox and Rockwell Collins and FLIR and Mentor Graphics, exactly the types of industries that our students work for ultimately. And if you take about a 30-35-mile radius around that campus, there are more than 100,000 community college students on campuses that go from Salem to Mount Hood, essentially to Clark County. And that transfer of students out of the community college system into finishing degrees with us in 2+3 types of programs is going to be critical, I think, again, to the access for a lot of Oregon students and for the development of graduates in these high-tech programs as we move forward. So let me leave you with a few things. We really have a unique niche in the Oregon University system. And that, we think, provides some ideal opportunities for collaboration in Oregon. I like to think of us as one of the most collaborative opportunity institutions going. Our focus on applied engineering science and the undergraduate and professional degrees and the Oregon student access is really ideal for Oregon as far as I'm concerned. Our connection with and attention to local business needs is also critical. That's especially true for this high technology and allied health sectors that we're so good at. And it's really the hallmark of our curriculum development and our postgraduate success. Because we're talking to the industries of what they want to hire and what skills they need, our students are very successful. They're ready to go right off the bat. And we have an already established operational presence throughout Oregon, and that really reflects our commitment to access and degree completion. So it's good news all the way around for the Oregon Tech Owls. And I'd be happy to address any questions or any comments that anyone would have. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here because this is a good news university.
Okay, I think there are questions from both sides. Senator Telfer, Vice Chair Telfer, why don't you go first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Maples, are you interfacing with the work that's going on at Newberry Crater at all? And if so, how much are you
The Geo Heat Center is aware of that, and my suspicion is that they have provided some background information to the company. One of the things the Geo Heat Center does is it's been an archive and a collecting area for a lot of the geothermal information in Oregon. Part of that is that they have also now become part of what's called an Intermountain West Geothermal Consortium that includes representatives from Boise State, University of Utah, University of Nevada. And so, again, it's a shared set of information. My guess is they've been asked for some of the information, what they know about the water, what they know about the geology, what they know about the heat gradient, which is the real critical component of all this. And have provided that information.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. The reason I asked was, to me it's fairly close to you. Mm-hmm. It's a major project. It's a great learning opportunity, and I just didn't know if you had students on the ground up there.
Not at this point. They're going to have to be a little farther along in actually getting something on in terms of having water available and putting a power plant in place. Since we have a power plant going and a very interesting new technology development in the power plant going in Klamath Falls, that's been our current focus. But we're in touch with them, and my guess is once it comes to that point, we'll be there. We've also been in touch with a couple of places doing potential biomass plant buildings. And we will be having some students involved in that as well.
Thank you. Senator Monroe.
Klamath Tribe is right in your area there, and there's been a lot of social problems with respect to Klamath Tribe. I have friends that have worked with them and so on. I just wondered if you had any programs to help assist in training the Native Americans in that area to better prepare them for a good life.
Interesting you should ask that. That's a direction we're headed right now. One of the things that we have been asked to do is to be involved in a consortium with that's being led by University of Alaska Anchorage. It's a very successful consortium that they've had going with National Science Foundation for some period of time. And what we will bring to the table is work in the high schools with Klamath, MODOC, Yahuska, and potentially other tribal groups in southern Oregon and northern California to get them involved in some of the science, technology, engineering, math types of fields while they're still in high school so that they're much better prepared when they walk into a college situation. And so that's one of the things that we have going. We have a faculty member now who has come to me and volunteered, and she is busy working with the Klamath Tribes. And we had a display talking about what Oregon Tech does and offers at the Klamath Tribe, the local powwow this year as well. So we are getting much closer to the Klamath Tribes.
Good. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And you really did start us off on a very upbeat note, because clearly, and as I said earlier, having visited the campus that I guess is one of the ones that's going to be consolidated into the Wilsonville campus, it's an amazing place, and just the amount of energy, the work that's going on, just talking to the students and how revved up everybody is, as well as just the sophistication of the programs that you're running out there is very impressive. So,
Thank you.
Really, to hear that every single one of your graduates is getting employed and at an average wage of $55,000 a year in this economy, that's also really
impressive. We're doing well, but we're listening to the industry in order to do well.
When is the Wilsonville campus slated to open?
Timeline for that is we are scheduled to open for our first set of classes 2012. We will, part of this is dependent on 11G bonding. We are the number one priority coming in from the Oregon University System for capital bonding. And so we will be asking for that, and we will be putting together our matching money to go with that, and we should be able to purchase the building in January 2013.
Great. Well, I also want to give a shout out to Lita Culligan, who I think is your capable assistant. I'm not sure what her title is, but it's probably much fancier than assistant, who also worked in this building for a long time as the governor's workforce policy advisor. So she was the one who helped the tour that I was part of, and
Lita has been instrumental in helping advance the overall recognition of Oregon Tech in the Portland metro area and in getting a lot of industry commitment and in working with our students and faculty and really advancing what we do. So I couldn't do this without her.
Well, thank you both. Thank you again for starting off our good news hearing here
Thanks
today.
Thanks again for the opportunity.
And members, we're going to go a little bit out of order on our agenda because we have a witness who needs to be in two places at one time, and even though I know he's capable of that, he's going to be here right now. So next we have Paul Cosgrove. And did you have somebody with you, Paul, too, or not? And so Paul's here to talk about the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership. And just a little background, committee members probably will remember this, but when we had the wonderful hearing that we did by teleconference that Senator Telfer arranged with all the folks from Bend, this program kept coming up in the discussion as one that was really benefiting some of the businesses in that area. So we thought it would be great to hear a little more about what OMEP does, what it is, and just sort of how we can make it even better.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and Senator Telfer, Senator Monroe. My name is Paul Cosgrove, representing Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, which we call OMEP, not to be confused with OMIP or OMAP.
Mm-hmm.
Pat Murphy is recovering, the executive director is recovering from surgery. Chris Shearer is here in case we have some technical budget questions. Chris is the acting director and the CFO of OMEP. But I'm pleased to be able to provide you some a little additional background about what OMEP is and what it does and how it helps Oregon's small manufacturers. And that is the OMEP is a team of manufacturing professionals, industrial engineers, and other professionals who are experts in lean enterprise training and implementation. So what is lean enterprise training and implementation? I'm not an industrial engineer, but I think the simplest way to describe it is it looks at business operations and it looks for efficiencies and waste to eliminate, to maximize efficiencies and eliminate waste, whether that be wasted energy, wasted materials, wasted space, inefficiencies in layout of processes and production lines. And it's particularly appropriate to follow Dr. Maples because we have a longstanding relationship with OIT. In fact, all of our industrial engineers and other professionals are actually technically staff of OIT. We pay OIT to hire our staff to pay their benefits, and we rent space from them. And so we, too, will be moving from our current location in Hillsboro at one of the OIT Portland area campuses to the new building in Wilsonville when it's available. OMEP receives funding, its base funding is from the National Institute of Science and Technology. It's a federal agency part of the U.S. Department of Commerce. And MEPs, Manufacturing Extension Partnerships, are in, I think, every state, if not every state, nearly every state. And they concentrate on working with small manufacturers to make them more efficient, more internationally competitive, more competitive in their niches. When I say small, the grant requirements for the ones the manufacturers supported in part by federal funds is for less than 500 employees. But in fact, Oregon is a small manufacturing state with a few very large exceptions, but it's a small manufacturing state. And most OMEP customers are in fact under 100 employees, and some are considerably smaller than that. We have a number of very interesting, very competitive, very good small manufacturers that are well under 100 employees. In fact, one of the handouts is this map, and this is a list of the most recent, updated through August 1st, companies with which OMEP has worked. And you'll see they're spread out all over the state. The organization spends a good deal of effort making sure that it tries to get to every corner of the state. There are a number of wonderful clients that we worked with in Deschutes County, and you heard from some of them in your last hearing, but there are also lots of other folks in other parts of the state, both metro and non-metro, rural and urban, who have benefited from OMEP's services. I need to thank, when I talked about the federal funding, I need to also thank a number of state legislators here, because in 2003, for the first time, the OMEP project received some state funding, and it's through the department we now call Business Oregon, the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department in prior years. And Representative Vicki Berger in the 2003 session was the advocate for funding from the state. Most recently, Senator Johnson and Representative Edwards to the Ways and Means process allocated $500,000 for this biennium. And the reason that's important is OMEP has been successful with federal funding, and it charges fees to its customers. But most of those federal funding opportunities come with match requirements. The basic grant is a 2-to-1 match, $2 of non-federal money to each dollar of federal money. And back in 2003, the allocation for Oregon from NIST, the National Institute of Science and Technology, portions of it were left on the table every year because we didn't have enough match. We appreciate the support the state's given us. It's one of the smaller pieces of our financial support. We've continued to be successful in getting significant additional special project federal grants from the U.S. Department of Labor, among others. But on almost all cases, that basic federal support with the state support we've received since the 2003-05 biennium has been critical in being able to continue to operate. I wanted to also mention it not only helps manufacturers, it helps the state. And I'd like to point out on the progress report for 2009-11, all of the data about the jobs created retained, 1,206 so far this biennium, and the increased investment in plant technology by customers of OMEP, almost $24 million, and increased to retain sales of over $59 million and the cost savings of $10. That comes from third-party survey data. As a requirement of the federal grant, they hire somebody after we've left a project to go back and talk to the company and say, what did it do? It's after the point that they have to feel like they have to be fluffy about what we're doing because they're hoping we'll come back because we're gone. The project is over. And that's one of the major issues that you always have in economic development programs is what good did it do? But the ROI, the return on investment, is pretty significant, and I think people in Business Oregon would suggest that this is probably the most efficient program that they have in terms of jobs created retained. For every dollar of state lottery money that is invested in OMEP, the ROI year-to-date is nearly $13 in state general fund money comes back, all in the same biennium, which is also unusual. It's quite a quick payback. That ROI was verified last session by an analysis out of our own legislative revenue office. It's not our data. It's the third party's survey data as analyzed by your legislative revenue office. So it's a program that, in fact, although it requires an expenditure of state funds, and we all know state funds, lottery funds, or general funds are in short supply these days, and frankly they have been ever since this program started to be funded. But it's also a program that can talk about how we can very quickly turn around and supply far more in general funds than we're using in lottery funds, plus help 1,200 Oregonians in good manufacturing jobs, which have not quite a $55,000 average annual salary, but I think the average manufacturing job is in the high 40s, low 50s, and so these are good, high-paying family wage jobs. On the back, we have a case study, and we could have picked a number, but we decided to pick one from Bend, given that you'd heard from some Bend companies, and you can talk, you can see what what happened in that project, if you have the time to read that over, and what the company reported, and allowing us to report to you some of the things about their increased sales and the particular dollar figures for any individual company. They get a little proprietary about, so we only report that in the aggregate, but this gives you, I think, some real data about what happened in one particular project with a quite a small company. 9 employees, which is not atypical for OMEP's customers. So with that, I'd be happy to answer whatever questions you have. If I can add one thing, because it's part of the tie-in to OIT. Some of the newer grants and some of the newer activities of OMEP are, in fact, directed toward the energy area. One of the newest of the Department of Labor grants is a grant to allow OMEP to work with companies that can be part of the supply chain for the renewable energy industry as a whole. There are a number of companies now, small Oregon companies that you may not have heard of, that are in fact supplying pieces for wind turbines and all sorts of other things for the renewable energy industry. And that grant is to help OMEP staff work with other companies to become efficient, to become competitive with people all over the country, and to expand the supply of their goods to those renewable energy manufacturers, the big boys that you hear about. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to come.
Well, great. And actually, Craig, I'm not sure you pronounce his last name, Ashatz, was one of the witnesses that testified from Bend when we had this other hearing when this kept coming up. So I think if we look at the Deschutes County list, we had a few of those businesses in that hearing. But one of the things I'm struck by, Paul, is just the incredible diversity of these businesses that are on the list of projects, because some of them are small, but some of them are big, and they're not all what I would call manufacturing companies either. I mean, the Red Cross is on here.
Well, and that's a good point. Madam Chair, one of the things that OMEP has done, especially when it needed to, when funding has been leaner, is it's broadened out beyond, in fact, sometimes just the manufacturing. I mean, when you think about it, process analysis and looking for efficiencies is a skill that can be applied to many institutions. There's been a project with Chemeketa Community College at Chemeketa's request to look at some of their processes, and you're correct, the Red Cross. Although its core and the money that comes from the federal government is directed to manufacturing, and I think you'll find that almost all of these folks on this list are manufacturers. The other, when you see some of the bigger companies, those are folks who are not being supported either by state or federal money. Those are people who are just hiring OMEP because they think they're good at doing it and they can help, and they're paying the full bore fees. So that also becomes part of the match that helps us keep the federal funding. So
questions for Paul? Looks like you've answered them all. What's the total budget then? Do you know?
$2.7 million
a year. And the $500,000 is a biennial, so it's been allocated at $250,000 a year. So it's about 10% state. The federal NIST grant is just shy of $800,000 at this point. And then the rest is fees and or special federal grants.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you
for being here today. And also for Chris, thank you for being there with that quick answer. Okay, so I think we're going to go back on our agenda to the order that we have it printed. And next on our agenda is a report from the Workforce Investment Board. We have both the Executive Director, Greg White, here, and also James Paulson, So welcome to you both. Welcome to the Senate Commerce and Workforce Development. I think what we wanted to hear from you today was just an update. I know there are some formal reports that will be coming to this committee probably at our December meeting that aren't quite ready, but I think you're going to just tell us what OWIB has been up to, what you're working on, what we can look forward to in the future with the particular emphasis on the good news.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to introduce and start it off. For the record, my name is Greg White. I'm executive staff to the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. And Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, we're really glad to be here today to tell you about what the chair just informed you we're going to tell you. So I think James is going to start off by talking about some of the basic stuff about the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. We're providing you with yet another copy of our strategic plan, which winning in the global market, which continues to guide our work, although it is a five-year plan that is entering its fifth year. But James will talk about that briefly. James Paulson is vice chair of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and one of our long-standing business members, and is very knowledgeable about our activities. James?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. Again, my name is James Paulson, and a little bit about me. I'm a native Oregonian, and I do live in Northeast Portland. So I'm very passionate about the state and the work that we're doing here around workforce development, as well as just a little bit about the work that we do. I am the vice chair of the OWIB, as well as I am the board chair of the Region 2, which is the local workforce investment board for Multnomah County and Washington County and the city of Portland. With these different boards, the boards are really industry-driven, and that's driven by local businesses all across the state. We have seven different local boards, and those boards are made up of people who work in industry, as well as economic development agencies, labor. And so these boards then move forward in looking at how they can address the challenges around workforce development in their different areas. With the OWIB kind of being integrated and working with all those different boards, we're able then to pull off a lot of strategic direction for the state. And with that, with the work that we've done in that strategic plan, one thing you'll notice that we're kind of at the end of the strategic plan. And one of the things that we've decided to do as a board is not move into the process of developing a new strategic plan, given that we are going to get a change in leadership here in November, or the first of the year. We felt that it was probably in our best interest to wait until that comes, because the governor really directs, as far as strategically, the direction in which the different boards and so forth go from a strategic basis. But given the strategic direction that we've started, we've identified four different key areas that we've wanted to focus on, and we've done a lot of work around that. And that then helps to describe the different projects and so forth that we've done in conjunction with that. So real briefly, what we've focused on is healthcare, manufacturing, green jobs, and with kind of an underlying high-wage, high-demand jobs statewide, because it only does us good to go and develop jobs that are actually going to make living wage or family wage jobs for Oregonians. So very briefly, I'd like to go into some different projects that we've done. Talking about one of the key projects that we've got underway is pulling together a national career readiness certificate. And what this is a tool that we're going to use so that we're able to evaluate individuals' career readiness. And what it'll do is it'll rank folks from gold, silver, and bronze as far as their career readiness. And how this is really going to be applied, it's kind of twofold. If you look on one side of the equation, you're going to have businesses that are going to be able to look at potential employees and say, wow, this position requires this level of career readiness, and here are folks who have that. And so, for example, let's say a business was looking to expand or locate here in the area, we would have a way of describing what that workforce readiness is. On the flip side, it's also a good tool for the folks who are
you know, looking to develop their skills and get a good understanding of where their skills are around career readiness, so then they would be able to say, I might be at this level, and how can I better my skills, and what sorts of things should I work on? So there again, it's kind of a tool that works both on the business outcome side as well as on the individual side. And I know Greg could get into some more details around the tool itself. But I want to move on and talk about some work that we've done for manufacturing. And we've pulled together a manufacturing committee, and we thought it was really important to really get our hands around manufacturing. Now, we understand manufacturing is not nearly as big as it maybe has once been in the state here, but it's in a very important piece of our economy. And some things that we've heard from manufacturing are that manufacturing is not a glamour job for youth. And we've heard that there's going to be a growing need for people within the manufacturing sector, for welders, machinists, and so forth. And we have to make sure that we have the pipeline of that talent available when they do move into that. So we pulled together this manufacturing committee, and they pulled together a manufacturing summit. And we had 70 different local manufacturers attend that summit. And given the size of the manufacturing community here in Oregon, that's a significant number of folks that are doing manufacturing in our state. And that group really identified, you know, some key challenges. One was there's a lack of foundation skills with the folks that are coming up. The negative public image about moving into a manufacturing career, as I talked about. Inadequate STEM knowledge, and STEM knowledge and skills are science, technology, engineering, and math. And workplace requirements are outpacing the skills of our current workforce. No longer is manufacturing someplace where you can just go and they give you all the training on the job. You need to come with a set of skills so that you're able to and ready for that type of training that's required in modern manufacturing. And so now that same group is now looking at ways in which they can engage and try and overcome and come up with plans on how we can address these different challenges that they've identified. The next committee that I'd like to talk about is some work that we've done around our youth and education. And basically we've come up with two major challenges that we've identified with the youth and education. You know, many students are leaving the public secondary school system without the skill sets to really be successful in careers. And that's a big challenge for us. And I think we heard it in some of the presentations earlier where it's really hard to find, and we need to start developing that talent so then we can start developing them into the types of jobs that are going to be more demanding going forward. And it starts with an education. And the second kind of goes right along that with students are lacking the technical skills in order to compete for the types of jobs that are in demand. And so what we've done is this group has come together and really gathered best practices on how to better address those two challenges, so then we can pull all those things together and then look at what our opportunities are from a Workforce Investment Board standpoint on how we can address those different things. And then the next committee would be around communications. And we've got some success here, and I've got actually a prop that I've blown up. And I don't know whether you're familiar with this logo. I hope you are. I hope everyone is familiar with this logo. This logo really talks to our system. And anyone that engages our system for any number of reasons, we've been able to go out and put this logo on all the different one-stop centers, the employment department, because we're trying to really build an integrated system in which people can gain services. Some other work that we've done are we've pulled together a website that's really directed toward youth and really trying to move into the more social networking and put a look and feel to this web experience that's going to talk to a youth. If I were to play the video right now that kind of describes some of the stuff that we're doing, I think a lot of people would say, that's way too busy. But I think it has a lot to do with the demographic in which we're talking to. And now what we're really trying to do is we're really trying to highlight the array of jobs that are out there to the youth, so then a youth can engage, have conversation about some different opportunities, so that people don't feel like, oh, I better become a nurse, a lawyer. There's a lot of other careers out there throughout a number of different fields. And this website really does a good job of conveying that.
Is that website address on these materials somewhere?
Yeah, it's called mypathcareers.org.
Or com.
Mypathcareers.org.
Or.com. Okay. Yeah, and that's a great site. And I encourage anyone to go out and take a look at that site. We've really tried to put some video in there. There's over 200 different videos talking about careers and so forth. So it's really engaging for folks. In the healthcare sector, and everyone knows that there's a lot of opportunities within healthcare, what we've really done is we've done some funding around a program. We partnered with the Oregon Center for Nursing and pulling together a data project on who gets in. And what we're really looking at there is trying to look at the pipeline of folks that are getting into nursing programs and looking at that pipeline, because we think that that's important. And I think everyone's kind of familiar with, you know, the challenges that we're faced with in the future around nursing and the challenge we're faced with around the pipeline of getting those nurses engaged. We've also worked with Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute and getting a better idea of this same pipeline of different healthcare occupations, so kind of going beyond just nursing and looking at what we have pipeline-wise for other allied health professions. And then we've also partnered with the Oregon Health Authority Board to apply for some federal grant funding, so we'll, hopefully that will also come together for us. The next area I'd like to talk about.
We're getting your website up on our screen here. That's what's going on.
Just get this up there? Okay.
Pay no attention to that woman behind the curtain.
Yes. So that's the WorkSource Oregon logo. We've done a lot of work for green jobs as well. And the OWIB has developed a green jobs plan for the state. That's what we were, House Bill 3300 kind of gave us that mandate. So then the governor appointed a green jobs council under the OWIB. And this council is made up of representatives from business, education, economic development, and labor. Again, it's very important when you're talking about workforce development that you bring all the key players to the table. And so that's one of the things that we thought was really important with the green jobs. And I think everyone understands the importance of preparing workers for green jobs, as, you know, nationally, and especially in this state, we see green jobs as being a great opportunity for employment going forward as we kind of move through this changing economy. So the Green Jobs Council submitted a draft plan with a process for completion to the legislature in January, with lots of background material and so forth. So the final plan is just getting completed right now. So this work is, you know, another reason why we'd be more than happy to come in front of you. But you'll hear more about green jobs, I understand, later on today. And so some good news is about the State Energy Sector Partnership and Training Grant. It's a grant that we applied for the DOL. It was part of the ERA funds, and only statewide boards were eligible to apply. We were lucky enough to receive the grant, which is, I want to make sure I get the numbers right here, so $5.38 million over the next 3 years, so almost $2 million a year. We plan to train over 1,100 unemployed, underemployed Oregonians into these different jobs, And definitely we want to place at least 300 into these green jobs. I think one of the things that's very interesting about this is the OWIB was able to kind of say, you know what we need to do is we need to really make a good accounting of those numbers, how many people were training and how many people were getting into jobs. And so that's a very important piece. And so we're going to be getting a continual report back, because I think that one of the things around creating jobs is actually keeping track of how many jobs you created, because we want to make sure that we do hit success on creating those 800 jobs with this grant. So we're putting a lot of focus and a lot of energy behind that program. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Greg.
And while we're making that transition, I'll just ask if the members have any questions, at this point. Okay, go ahead, Greg.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I really don't have much to add. I think James hit it pretty much on the head. We do have a ton of stuff going on that's all good news. a couple of the things that James might have left out is that the OWIB actually early in this governor's administration created the Employer Workforce Training Fund, which is an incumbent worker training program, and also the funding by which we do a lot of the innovative and far looking forward type of projects that we've been able to pull together that James talked about through some of the small but available Workforce Investment Act funding that's under the control of the governor. And also under for the National Career Readiness Certificate, I think it's important to note that that's a portable certificate that's good anywhere in the United States, that's recognized everywhere, and that, as James shows actual practical working knowledge in the areas of reading, math, and locating information, which are the skills that the employers say they need most. And that was actually House Bill 2398 that actually asked the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to develop the National Career Readiness Certificate. There was no funding attached. The OWIB, through its flexible funding, was able to give it some seed funding, and it has been carried forward with the governor's Flexible Workforce Investment Act funding since. The Green Jobs Council was mentioned and covered quite well. The Green Jobs Growth Plan that was required in House Bill 3300 was what Chair Rosenbaum was talking about earlier, and something that will come back to you in December. That is actually a report that will be delivered in final form to the legislature for the next session. But in December, we're going to be able to give the legislature some of the results and recommendations from that report. Thank you very much.
So I think we do have time for a couple of questions, and I do want to ask you, I think, two questions. So we're not the Ways and Means Committee, or the Emergency Board, and thank God for that this week. But I do think it's important to just ask you to talk a little bit about what your overall budget for OWIB is, and what the sort. I know obviously a lot of grant money flows through OWIB, but if you could just talk, Greg, probably Greg, this is a question to you, a little more about what's your budget and what is the relationship between OWIB and the local councils as far as how funding flows.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, the OWIB has a very small budget, hardly has any money at all. It's an advisory board. It's not a state agency. We're advisory to the governor, a policy and advisory board. However, we do try to coordinate the workforce activities in the state. The last time we looked, if you include all of the TANF funding, not the grants, the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, which we consider a workforce program because it gets people into jobs, not including the grants, vocational rehabilitation, Carl Perkins vocational, at least the post-secondary portion of that, the adult basic skills funding, Title II of the Workforce Investment Act, the employment service programs, and I'm probably forgetting others, of all of the Workforce Investment Act, adult, youth, and dislocated worker programs, we're probably talking at least $500 million in total. But that is not the OWIB's budget. That's under the control of various state agencies. Also, there are local funds that come into that. I would say that when we talk about our workforce system in this state, we're talking about a system that we've been able to put together that consists of various categorical federal programs, all with different funding sources, different reporting requirements, different target populations. So in many ways, we are tied to the constrictions of the federal government. We're talking largely a federal program here. There's very little state funding in this. And in fact, if these were better times, I would be saying we really need some. Because in order to do some of the things that we really would like to do, we need more flexible funding that isn't tied to these specific target groups. We've been able to carve a little bit off, as we talked about with the Employer Workforce Training Fund, but that's the extent of what we've been able to do, and that's very small. That's about The entire Employer Workforce Training Fund is made up of three parts. The first part, 65%, goes to the local workforce investment boards for incumbent worker projects working directly with businesses. There's approximately 25% that is held by the OWIB for approval of specific projects. We call that Statewide Opportunity Fund. And then there's the remainder, a small amount, is for the governor to use. That's usually used for training after a company has been located here or attracted here by the economic development folks. There is very little, and I would say that total fund is probably less than $3 million, so we're really not talking about a very big amount of money that the OWIB controls or that OWIB has approval authority over.
The $3 million was the governor's discretionary
fund? Yeah, that's a portion of the governor's discretionary funding, and I could get you the exact amount because I know that I'm not being very exact with that.
Well, and we didn't ask you to come prepared with a budget presentation today, but I think it is helpful just to know because this is such an important policy area. So the Perkins funds are federal funds that are designated for career and technical education,
and they come to both the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development and the Department of Education, and they share those funds through agreements between them, because there's a post-secondary and a secondary portion. I do have actually a list of the kinds of programs that we have funded and how much they are, and I would say that I'll just list them here: our Green Jobs Growth Initiative Plan, our a Manufacturing Committee support. We're planning to do an Employer Workforce Training Fund evaluation. We're also doing a more of a public. I don't know what you'd call it. We're going to tell the story of the Employer Workforce Training Fund because it's been so transformative to our workforce system. And we're going to be starting a phase one of evaluating what our current strategic plan has done so that we're prepared for our next strategic planning effort. A small amount for our youth and education activities that James was talking about, and our green sector's economic impact study, all of which add up to approximately $450,000 that the OWIB actually approves those projects.
Okay. Any other questions from committee members? Looks like you've answered them all. Okay. Well, thank you very much, and we'll
thank
look
you.
Forward to seeing you again, I believe.
I'll be working with Teresa to put something together that I think will be very instructive for everyone. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, both of you, for being here today. So then I think our next two items on the agenda are two presenters who are going to come up together, and one is our old friend, not because he's old, but because we see a lot of him and we love to hear from him, Graham Slater, and then is Charlie Johnson here too? Great. So the topic of this presentation is hearing from the Employment Department, I think about specifically the green jobs topic that has been talked about a lot earlier, but also I think more broadly, Graham, what we were interested, at least what I was interested in hearing, is just sort of what is it looking like out in Oregon in terms of where the jobs are, places that are expanding. You know, I don't have a good feel for, I know I opened the newspaper and it seems like now there are, in addition to the usual sad stories about layoffs and closures, there are a lot of stories about expansions and some pretty big numbers of jobs in some places. So I'm hoping that you can give us kind of that bigger picture perspective too. So,
okay. So Madam Chair, members of the committee, the record, Graham Slater with the Research Division in the Employment Department. And my first role here really is to introduce Charlie Johnson, who's one of our newer economists, came to us and really stepped forward when we did the Green Jobs Survey for Oregon about a year and a half ago. And then back in December, we received a federal grant specifically to dig deeper into green jobs. And Charlie was assigned that position as our green jobs economist. So for this 18-month grant, at least, Charlie's kind of the man to really study the green jobs. So let's go to the green jobs part first, and then I will follow up with the broader economic employment news, trying to keep it a good news hearing. I'll work really hard at that, Madam Chair. So
I think Charlie. People are going to get pretty sick of my joke. But not that it was a joke. It was a theme. So, so Charlie, if you could identify yourself for the record and then take it away.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Charlie Johnson. I'm the Green Jobs Economist with the Oregon Employment Department. And today I will share an overview of a recent study of green jobs that we conducted that was funded by the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and then some preliminary research that's being funded by a Department of Labor grant. And that grant currently funds two positions in our department, one of which is mine, and will expire in May of 2011.
And that second grant was about $1 million from the Department of Labor, right?
$1.25 million, yes. Oregon has an official definition of a green job, and this was adopted by the Oregon Legislature in House Bill 3300 during the previous session. The definition is similar to most, but not identical to any of the definitions being used by other states throughout the nation. The proposed federal definition of a green job is also similar. As you can see, the definition is primarily focused on job activities. The definition does not consider a person's occupation or industry of employment as evidence of being a green job. And this is important because we're not really able to assume that all jobs within any given occupation are green jobs. As a result, the most accurate way to measure green jobs is through employer surveys. And we conducted a statewide survey of employers last year, asking them for information about their green jobs. And what we found was that in the year 2008, Oregon had roughly 51,000 green jobs, and that they accounted for roughly 3% of the state's non-federal workforce. Similar surveys conducted by other states have confirmed that green jobs typically account for between 2 and 4% of all jobs. Employers also indicated to us that green jobs are found in a wide array of industries and occupations. They are not necessarily a highly specialized small subset of all jobs. And they also predicted that their green jobs employment would increase by about 7,400 positions over the two-year time frame from 2008 to 2010. However, no follow-up survey has been conducted at this time to confirm that. In our survey, we found that the majority of green jobs are found in what are traditionally thought of as blue-collar occupations, primarily in construction, production, and agriculture. We also found that there are very few green jobs in certain low-paying occupations. For example, there are not many green jobs found in service occupations that serve coffee or ring you up at the department store. And as a result, average wages for green jobs tend to be slightly higher than the average wage for all jobs. Employers indicated to us that roughly two-thirds of their green jobs require no education beyond high school. However, they also indicated that nearly one-third of all green jobs require some sort of special license or certificate. This may indicate that these low education positions are receiving additional education and training just outside of the community college or Oregon University system. One research activity that our office is working on currently is the study of green sectors. And these are groups of businesses that are performing similar green activities. This is not a study of green jobs per se. It's more a study of all of the jobs at these companies. And we're focusing on green sectors that have been identified by the Oregon Green Jobs Council. And we've completed two analyses thus far. We are currently studying the energy efficiency and weatherization sector. And we hope to continue that research and complete research in all of these sectors before the end of our grant period. There are more than 200 firms that produce renewable energy in Oregon, but the vast majority consume all of the energy that they produce. The Department of Energy was able to identify 13 firms that produce renewable energy in excess of their consumption and sold that electricity back to the grid. So when we look at just those 13 firms, we found that this sector employed roughly 11,000 people late last year and had experienced a substantial decline in employment over the previous five-year period compared to other areas of the economy. We also found that employment and wage trends in this sector tend to be dominated by wood and paper products manufacturing. And the reason for that is a number of those firms use their byproducts to produce electricity. As a result, the median wage in the sector is nearly double the median wage for all private sector jobs in Oregon. However, when looking at jobs in the sector, because we're considering all jobs, not green jobs, it's very unlikely that very many jobs in the sector are directly related to producing renewable energy. We also studied the green manufacturing sector, and we found that this sector had seen significant growth in recent years, but the total size is still much smaller than the renewable energy sector. Employees in the sector tend to have slightly lower wages than their counterparts in other manufacturing firms, but their wages are still much higher than the median for all private sector jobs. The next analysis will bring the focus back to green jobs specifically. Although our office does not track hiring per se, we are able to use online job ads that are posted by employers as a proxy to talk about current labor demands. And what we found was that in August, Oregon employers were advertising just more than 50,000 open positions throughout the state, of which about 2% were for green jobs. And those green job ads were more concentrated in things like engineering and sciences than all jobs were. Roughly 50% of the state's green jobs were advertised in the Portland metro area, and this basically mirrors the geographical distribution for all jobs in the state. We also studied the growth of ads for green jobs and all jobs in each of the state's metropolitan areas over the year, and what we found was that there was really no correlation between the two. Salem outperformed other areas of the state in growth of green job ads, but experienced the slowest growth in all job ads over the period, whereas Corvallis experienced the fastest growth in all job ads, nearly 60%, but saw no change whatsoever in the number of green jobs advertised in the area. A few well-known employers were advertising 25 or more open green jobs during the month, but the three Oregon employers who advertised the most jobs overall were all in the healthcare sector. And those three healthcare providers alone were advertising for more jobs than all green jobs combined in the state during the month.
So when you say that SolarWorld, Intel, and GE advertise green jobs, are you saying jobs fitting the definition that you earlier gave us, or they actually put the term green jobs in their ad?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Jobs that meet the definition, according to our best analysis, but it's not necessarily an indication that they fill those positions.
But they had openings,
mm-hmm.
Clearly.
Correct, yes.
Okay.
And then, if I may, I'd like to end with just a few general points about green jobs based on our findings. They certainly exist, but they are not really a new phenomenon. Many jobs in the state's agriculture sector, for example, have likely met the state's definition of a green job for decades, if not longer. Green jobs are widely dispersed throughout Oregon's workforce. They're not totally encompassed by the solar and wind sectors, although those groups certainly do employ green jobs in the state. In fact, the construction sector employs more green jobs than any other industry. And finally, studies being conducted by our office and other labor market information groups across the country indicate that green jobs account for a fairly small portion of the workforce and will continue to account for a small portion of the workforce in the near future. However, there is some evidence that many existing jobs are becoming more green, basically existing jobs that are adding green activities to their previous job duties, and we do expect that that trend will continue in the future. All right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Charlie, and I think this probably is a good juncture to take some questions about this report. And I will start. So I'm not sure this is good news because what I'm getting from this is that green jobs is kind of this trendy term, and everybody likes to talk about green jobs as if they were going to be these really good-paying jobs, which will become increasingly plentiful. And Oregon in particular, you know, has made, and I think rightly so, made ourselves a goal of attracting a lot of renewable energy businesses and, you know, car companies that are making energy-efficient cars. But we do that partly because we believe that this will attract a lot of jobs that'll pay a lot. And so you're telling us that there aren't really as many of these jobs necessarily as we thought there were, and also that most of them only require a high school diploma. And then I'm not quite sure if I got what the average wage of green jobs generally is, but if the jobs mostly require only a high school diploma, they're probably not going to be the best paying jobs that we really want to have be the jobs of our future.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, to address your main point, there is a difference between the minimum education required by an employer and what we consider a competitive education level for an open position. For our survey, we asked about the minimum education. We did not ask about the competitive education. So it's completely possible that employers were responding in a way to try to indicate that they would be willing to take somebody with a high school education if that person had the right skills and knowledge necessary, but that they weren't specifically looking for someone who had higher education. To address your other point, our research shows that employers are very optimistic about green jobs growth. They projected a 14% increase in the number of green jobs between 2008 and 2010, which, to put that in perspective, for all jobs across the economy, we have estimated that employment in Oregon will increase by roughly 9% from 2008 to 2018, so over a 10-year time frame, 9%, compared to 14% in a 2-year time frame, and that's very optimistic. And I think that that definitely goes to show that employers are very optimistic about green jobs growth.
So do you, but the survey was done in 2008, correct?
Correct, yes.
And then the projection then was that there would be about close to 59,000 of these jobs by now.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And is there any way of evaluating how many there actually are?
Madam Chair? We could conduct a follow-up survey, but we have not been asked to do that yet.
But, I mean, there's no way to just sort of extrapolate from what you see in terms of the ads for hiring people and just kind of, I mean, clearly maybe it's not just a function of the Employment Department. I think over at the Department of Energy, where when Senator Telfer and I are on the Revenue Committee, we're hearing a lot about jobs in terms of the BEPSI tax credit and other programs. There is a lot of discussion about jobs in renewable energy and real metrics about how many jobs there are, how much they pay. I mean, that's part of the application process for those tax credits. So right now, though, you don't have any idea, really, how many green jobs exist in Oregon.
Well, Madam Chair, why don't I jump in? I mean, I think the basic answer to that question is no. And part of that, if you look back over that 2008 to 2010 period, remember, Oregon was losing thousands of jobs. This most industries weren't even thinking about adding jobs. Now, if there was some increase in the number of green jobs, that was a very positive thing counter to everything else going on in the state. When we do these surveys, you know, we look at about 50,000 green jobs, and one of the things that we tried to do in our report was to give you a sense of how big is that. And it was about the same number of people that work for hospitals in Oregon. So, you know, this isn't, from us anyway, this isn't a value judgment of 50,000 green jobs is good or bad. There are 50,000 really important jobs, and certainly from our state's point of view, societal, environmental, they're jobs that I think most people would agree have a high value outside of just being a job for the sake of everything we believe in Oregon. But right now, it is only 50,000. It is not the hundreds of thousands that you sometimes make sense from what you hear and read, nor do we believe it's the solution to the recession, which you don't hear as much now, but certainly a year or two ago, you almost were hearing that kind of talk. Every new green job, every new high-wage green job is a wonderful thing. Any new job in Oregon is a wonderful thing right now. But there's just simply not enough green jobs to say that's the solution to the recession. Mm-hmm. And if you think of a lot of those announcements that you've probably seen, you know, it may be 300 or 400 jobs for the construction of the new wind farm or the new whatever it is, and it may be 50 jobs or 200 jobs for the ongoing operation of that green company, whatever they're doing. But when we've lost 150,000 jobs, the 200s, the 300s, they're really, really important, but they don't get you to totally good news, you know. So it's kind of a perspective of how it fits with this huge overall economy.
Senator Monroe, did you have a question?
I'm okay.
And I don't know if you were here at the beginning when the Oregon Institute of Technology was presenting, but clearly they are training people for some extremely well-paying jobs, and all of their graduates are getting hired. So I would assume, although I forgot to ask them this, that they probably could, if they had more slots, train even more people who would go out there and get hired pretty quickly. And that's amazing in this time of pretty severe unemployment. That so there clearly is a niche, or more than a niche there, of some jobs that we could be training Oregonians for, where they would get hired in Oregon and other states.
Right. Well, and Madam Chairman, two thoughts on that. It was a great presentation, but remember they were talking, I think the total number was 20, mm-hmm. and maybe moving it up to 26 in the coming year. So again, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of jobs, and it's great that there's 20 super high-wage, super skilled jobs. I mean, that's great. I'm not taking away from that in any way. I do think there was another interesting thing when we first did the survey, and that was that of those jobs that did not require a high school education, the wages were actually pretty decent. And so I've said in presentations quite a few times, you know, don't say that Graham Slater said, drop out of high school, get a green job, because that's not what I'm saying. But if you are a high school dropout, in quotes, some of these green lower-skill jobs actually pay pretty well compared with working in fast food or some of the real minimum wage jobs. And in some of those, you do need, as Charlie mentioned, you do need some kind of extra license or certification. So it's not just quit high school and go get the job. It's quit high school and go get this license or certification, and then you can work. One example I remember was hazardous materials workers. You know, do you want to spend 30 years dealing with hazardous materials? That's kind of a rough thing to do day after day. But given the skill level, you do get paid pretty well. You probably deserve it to deal with that stuff. So,
or hopefully graduate from high school and get that certification.
Absolutely, right.
I mean, it just can't be good advice to anybody.
Right.
And we've got a huge problem already with people not graduating from high school. So.
And let me make it clear, I always say that is not the advice I'm giving.
Right.
But for those in that situation, some of these jobs may provide a whole lot better wage than they've ever dreamed of before. So if you're already in that situation.
Right. So. Okay, well, great. That's all the questions I had. If you want to continue, so that would be great.
I need access to the laptop because I'm a compulsive driver of the laptop. So should we switch?
You can't talk without a laptop.
Absolutely not.
Actually, you know, our first presenters gave us their whole presentation on a little flash drive here. So,
very good.
I don't know how much this is worth, but you've now got a flash drive. That's the first time I've ever seen a witness do that.
It's because they're a technology.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, so Madam Chair and members of the committee, we'll move kind of into your next agenda item, if that's okay, the hiring trends. And I'm going to go right back to the last week of May. If you remember, I was here with you that Monday morning before I flew off to Minneapolis, I remember. And one of the questions you asked that time specifically was, how many jobs do we need to create to bring our unemployment rate down? And so I chatted with you about, in rough numbers, we needed 1,500 jobs a month just to kind of keep things equal. And if we really wanted to bring the unemployment rate down to, say, 6%, you know, where we'd love it to be, we're a long way from there, we'd need to be adding 4,000 or 5,000 jobs per month every month for several years, 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 years. So this first graph today just shows you the unemployment rate as it is now, you know, as it's progressed through the summer. And what you really see is it hasn't changed since May. So unfortunately, that ideal of bringing down the unemployment rate, it simply isn't happening, and I'll explain why. On the bright side, it is down from where it was a year ago, and it doesn't appear to be climbing. So we've kind of hit this kind of flat period for almost 10 months now, where there's just not enough going on, hiring or laying off, to really budge the unemployment rate. So in the one sense, I guess it's good that it's not getting worse. But on the other sense, clearly what we all want is an unemployment rate getting down into the 8s and 7s and 6% range, and that's not happening. And the main reason it's not happening is that we're simply not seeing enough job growth. I mean, the chair's right. There's been some good announcements. There's been a few hundred jobs here and there, and I'm sure there's lots of smaller companies adding 2 and 5 jobs. But we're not seeing month after month the kind of job growth we need. And you've seen that from Tom Potowski's forecast. I mean, you directly see the consequence of that lack of job growth. One of the real complications as we came out of this recession period was that we had the census. And it was wonderful to get 6,000 jobs just kind of dumped into the economy in Oregon and many more nationwide. But it really made a mess of the graphs because you suddenly get 6,000 new jobs in April and everybody gets excited. Oh, we're recovering. And then in May and June and July and onwards, we start losing 500 or 1,000 jobs as the census workers are let go. So this graph actually just ignores the census. It takes out everything to do with the census. And you can see the red and downward is bad. The green and upward is good. And I told you in May we needed to add 4,000 jobs per month, every month, to really see some progress. And we did that in April, which was great. We did it in June, which was great. But we're not doing it, as you can see, consistently month after month. So therein lies the biggest challenge for Oregon right now, and for the nation, and for most states. I mean, we're not unique in this situation. Just yesterday, there was the announcement that the recession officially ended in June of last year. And from all the economic purists, and I'm not one of them, Charlie might be, but for all the economic purists, all those data make sense. But clearly, as happened in the last recession, you can say the recession's over. It does not mean that jobs are starting to be added right away. And I think I have a graph in a second that shows you even in the last recession, you may remember, most of you have been around a while, the jobless recovery. And that's kind of the concept of what we're in right now. Here's a picture of some of what I would consider kind of the key private sector industries. And it's indexed, so at the beginning of the recession, they all start at the same point, and then most of them go down. You can see health services is the only exception, and it actually creeps up. It's above that big, thick line, which means it's employing more people today than it did at the start of the recession. But all these other industries, construction, manufacturing on through, they clearly dump down in some cases, construction down almost 40%. From its start at the beginning of the recession. And I think there's two things for you to look at there. Number one is how much did each line go down, because that was the losses. Number two is how much has each line started bouncing back up? And the answer for the most part to the second question is not much. And again, that's the same problem that I've already articulated. We seem to have leveled off. We're not losing thousands of jobs anymore. We're actually adding some jobs. Other companies might be losing a few jobs. But overall, when you count them all up, we're pretty flat, and that is not the way that we're going to get to more lower and lower unemployment by people finding jobs. It's just too flat. We need it to start. We need all of these industries, really, to start picking up. So far, it's clearly not happening. I wanted to put this in the context of the official forecast, Tom Potowski's forecast, because I don't want to give you the message that because this is flat, you necessarily have to expect, you know, another budget problem with Tom's December forecast. What's happened in July and August is pretty consistent with what Tom is forecasting. So in a sense, yeah, he forecasted not much growth, in fact, no growth in this quarter. And that's exactly what the numbers are turning out to be. So far, no big surprises. It's pretty much playing out the way that Tom told you it would just a few weeks ago. Now, of course, every quarter he takes more of our numbers, he takes more national numbers, and he updates his forecast. And unfortunately, recently, it just keeps getting worse. But hopefully, that will turn around at some point here. Hopefully for his sake, as well as all of ours. On the bright side, we do have a new partnership with the Conference Board, very exciting partnership, where they are actually taking help wanted ads from online sources, loads of online sources. Years ago, they used to publish the Help Wanted Index, which was from newspapers. Of course, people don't advertise in newspapers as much. They still do to some extent. So about a year ago, we were able to sign a contract with the Conference Board. We now get this data every month, and we can look at this, and the top line there shows the total online job ads for Oregon. It certainly doesn't include every single ad, but it's an attempt by the Conference Board to look at the ads across all these different job boards, take out the duplicates, do some data cleanup, and then make sense in a data series. And the good news is you can see we have shown some growth from where we were last summer. So that's positive. The bottom line is the number of totally new ads, and it's also up from last summer. So I think that starts to feed into, you know, the chair's feelings about there being some new openings, some new announcements. It's feeling a little bit more bright than it was a year ago. This graph would support that. And then we wanted to look at some specific ads. I'm not going to talk in detail about individual companies. I don't claim to be an expert on every one of these. But we do have a nice little publication that we distribute every Thursday afternoon. And I actually checked, and none of your committee are on the mailing list for this. Quite a few legislators are. It's called Around the State, and it's the least statistical thing we do. It's kind of a news clipping service from our economists who are spread around Oregon. And it's a great, easy Thursday afternoon read to just say, was there good news or bad news this week? And who's adding a lot of jobs? We'll pass these out maybe at the end. But you can see a non-statistical analysis. If we look at the last 4 weeks, there were 95 positive announcements, and 8 of them were for at least 50 employees. And there were only 12 negative announcements. Okay, now this is not statistically valid data. This is news clippings. But it just gives you a sense, particularly when you look a year ago for the same four-week period, it was a 76-27 ratio. So that's not startlingly better, but it's somewhat better. And I just kind of wanted to put that in context. What I'd like to do now is just take you through some of the bigger ones of the last few months that the staff put together for this hearing today. I'm not going to read them to you. I'm not going to elaborate on them. The name of the company and the location is bolded. The number of jobs is red and pretty easy to pick out. And I think it does get back to, yes, there's been some good news. So 100 jobs, you know, 600 jobs for both of those in construction. And we know there's a lot more going on in construction than just these two. But they're just examples of the kinds of things we're seeing. In manufacturing, 150. It expects to employ 150 in Bend, adding 260 jobs in Portland. I mean, those are probably some of the things you've been seeing. And definitely, compared with where we were 18 months ago, these are great news. You know, adding 260 jobs at a time, 4 of those, you get to 1,000. But you need 150,000 to get back all that we lost. It's just daunting, the size of the losses. Tom's forecast, of course, takes us all the way out to the end of 2014 before we get back to the previous employment level. So even if we've hit bottom, it's going to take us a long while to get back up. Good news in wood products, even, which we know, you know, in the last 20 years, there's been some good news, but there's been a lot of bad news. So the Murphy Company, 150. Warm Springs, this one's saving 115 jobs. Well, that's a lot better than the option of losing them. But then one company down there in the Roseburg area, closing. So there's 90 jobs gone. So you win some. Unfortunately, you also lose some. Some green manufacturing, 250, 350, and 100, maybe 170 over time. So pretty positive news there on the green side. Retail trade, some layoffs, but also a couple of companies adding employees. Okay, so that, again, not just manufacturing, it's across a wide range of industries. Layoffs there in the airline industry, but a couple of big looking at hires in this transportation information group. 600 new employees, that's probably the biggest single one that we'll show today. That's huge from where we've been recently. Professional business services, customer service company with 500, but then some layoffs of 150. So sometimes, you know, you gain 500, you lose 200. In the last slide, you actually gain 200 great jobs here in the Salem area, but then you lose 200 in Northwest Portland. So the bottom line is, if you just kind of even think about those numbers and you just mentally added them up, you've added several thousand probably, but you've also lost a couple thousand, you know, and that's been the story as we've gone through this summer. We've had some real good news, but we're not yet to the point where it's almost all good news, and certainly not big good news. Just closing slide from me, obviously we continue monitoring all this. We do a monthly survey that specifically asks businesses, how many employees did you have last month? That's one of the things we release alongside the unemployment rate each month. And that will be October 19th, will be the next statewide news release. So you know, every month, as soon as we can get all the surveys together in kind of collaboration with the feds and other states, because we all use the same methodologies, we get those out as early as we can. And I just wanted to close with what I think is really good news, and that is that we're at the point on our economic website for the research division where every one of those job openings that we've mentioned, both from the employment department's iMatch skills system, the job openings that are listed with our agency, but also all of the ones from the conference board that they send us, which is actually quite a few more than we have just through the employment department, every one of those job openings is listed on our website. So if you're a welder and you're looking for work, and you go to our website to find out, you know, where's the growth going to be, what kinds of companies hire welders, one of the first things we show you, even though it's kind of an economic website or a career website, one of the first things we show you is here's the welder openings through the employment department, and here's a bunch more welder openings through all kinds of sources. So if you really want a job and you don't want just statistics, here's where you can go. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, these people can go to the employment office or log into the employment iMatch skills system and within seconds be applying for those jobs. So it's kind of a nice partnership between the statistics guys like Charlie and me and the actual people on the front line trying to help people find a job. So that ends my presentation. I'll be happy to take questions. Thanks.
Great. It looks like Senator Monroe has one.
Well, maybe more of a comment. I actually taught economics for a while when I was a teacher, and it frustrates me when I watch the television news and everything about how they talk about the recession being over for more than a year now and, mm-hmm. and so on. They don't do enough to explain what a recession is and, you know, why, you know, a recession is when GDP declines for, what, three quarters in a row, then you're in a recession. And of course, you don't know that until the 3 year are over, so it's always prospective. But, you know, you could start your economies up here going along 2007, and all of a sudden it falls off a cliff, and it goes down, 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 down until June of 2009. Then does it go back up? No. It just doesn't keep going down. And that's essentially what we've had for more than the last year. It's essentially it's been flat, not declining further, maybe slightly getting better, but really no real recovery. I think people get the term recession and the term recovery mixed up. An end of a recession doesn't mean you have recovery. It means that things are not continuing to get worse and worse and worse. And I don't think they do a good enough job of explaining that, because then they go out and they stick a mic and so-and-so says, well, you know, the economists have said the recession's been over for over a year. What do you think about that? Well, those economists are crazy. They don't know what they're talking about. Well, it's because they don't define what a recession is, and, you know, and what it is not. It is not a recovery.
Madam Chairman, I would agree. And can we put this slide back up for a second? I mean, I would agree with everything the economics teacher has said. but I just want to point out, if you look back to the last recession, exactly the same thing happened, where it was a much milder recession, of course. But you can see we kind of lost jobs for several months in a row. And then some people were saying the recession is over. But you can see probably 8 or 10 or 12 months before we started any kind of job growth. And that's been true in a number of recessions, much worse this time, clearly. I mean, we're really hurting this time, so.
Well, I am not an economist, and boy, I wouldn't want to be one right now, because it seems like, I mean, I think you guys are great, but it seems like a very, very challenging time to try to advocate or even explain what's going on in the world economy, but there are some things that you might know the answer to that I don't. So, for instance, you know, Oregon has had a higher unemployment rate just as long as I've been in Oregon than the national average, and I get asked periodically, why is that? And I know Art Ehr, before he retired, did this huge report and presented it to the City Club, and honestly, I haven't read it. I've heard a little about it, but it doesn't seem that he really knew the answer to that question. And then you look across the border at the state of Washington, and you see their unemployment rate significantly better than Oregon's, at least statewide. But in Vancouver, just across the border from Portland, I think they're at about 14% unemployment, if I'm not mistaken. So it's hard for me to understand what's so different in Washington and in Oregon. And then I think, you know, just to kind of bring it back to reality, as policymakers, the question we really want the answer to is there anything we can do to make it better? I mean, and that's both helping create those jobs and also preparing workers. I think you guys have some great things that you've done, clearly posting all those job openings and making it easier for people to apply for them as one. But, you know, I think that really is the fundamental question for most legislators, is how to attract and grow more jobs and then put the right people in a position to get those jobs. So that's a lot of questions strung out together, and you can answer any of them or none of them.
Well, Madam Chair, I find it ironic. I really am not an economist. I'm a statistics guy, so I hire great economists. But let me answer a couple of things. First of all, just for the record, Art didn't retire. He's now a budget analyst, budget analyst at the Department of Administrative Services.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know
so
that.
So you may well be seeing him if you're on some budget committees next year, and as great guy as he's always been. We're actually very close to wrapping up a study on per capita personal income, which is the other thing that people are very concerned about. Yes, we tend to have a higher unemployment rate than a lot of other states, and our per capita personal income, our total income divided by the population, tends to be a lot lower than a lot of states. So you put those two together, and it's no wonder we have some budget problems, right? So we've been doing a lot of work on that, and I think some of the factors are equally valuable when you try to figure out why we have a high unemployment rate and why we have lower incomes. And one of the biggest ones probably is our population growth. You know, when I give speeches, I often say, put your hand in the air if you were not born in Oregon. I wasn't, obviously. Usually 50 to 75% of the people in the room put their hand up in the air. And I joke with them and I say, in the good times, we're all part of the solution. In the bad times, we're all part of the problem. Because in some states, the South Dakotas, the Nebraskas, they have 3% unemployment rates, but it's because all the unemployed are leaving town. You know, we could do that too if all the unemployed left town. That's not the nature of Oregon. We keep moving here. It's a wonderful state to be in, despite some of our problems. And when people do get unemployed in Michigan, they move to Oregon. Not everybody, but anecdotes. When people get unemployed in Oregon, they often stay in Oregon because they believe it's going to get better at some point. So there are a number of other reasons on the income side. We do tend to pay less across a lot of different industries. And even part of that is the fact, you know, if you've got a lot of people moving here, you may not have to offer as much for wages because there's a lot of unemployed people who compete for the job. So it kind of all links together. As far as policies, we were asked in this per capita personal income report to actually suggest at least some factors that people, legislators and others, could think about in terms of policies. And we try to keep ourselves pure. You know, we're the data people and we're not the policy experts, but we understand that people like you would say to us, but what do you really think? And so there's 7 or 8 factors at the end of that report that I think would be equally valuable for unemployment rates or raising incomes. And clearly one of them is just doing whatever we can to have an environment where all kinds of businesses will either want to move here or have the ability to expand here. And that's the expertise of the economic development folks, although we do talk to them a lot. I'm sure they could come and give you a lot more ideas. But clearly, if there's no businesses growing or coming to Oregon, growing here or coming, we don't have any job openings to post for people to apply for. And that's one of the things we have to work hard at. There will always be the retirements, and you've heard me give those speeches, but I'm talking about the new growth. We've got to have our companies expanding, and we've got to have new companies coming while maintaining the environmental standards that Oregonians as a group really value, and that's where it can get pretty difficult.
And you didn't really address the Washington-Oregon difference.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I thought I jotted them all down. I don't have a super easy answer. When I've looked at that before, or when people like Art or Charlie have looked at that before, I think one of the factors that always comes to my mind is that, like Oregon, Washington has a lot of healthy components to its economy, a lot of diversity, a lot of manufacturing. And we got clobbered in this recession because we do have a lot of manufacturing, and you know, other states would envy where we are in manufacturing. In Washington, of course, they have two huge manufacturing. You know, they've got Microsoft and they've got Boeing. And if those companies are relatively stable, that's an incredible stability for their whole economy. Whereas if we've got a bunch of moderate-sized companies, all of whom or most of whom are suffering in this huge recession, our manufacturing is going like this. Theirs probably went down. I haven't looked. But I'm guessing, you know, those two companies and all of the companies that serve them, reasonably stable, that would be a great thing to have during these really bad times. It's what we used to say about Benton County in Oregon, where you had Hewlett-Packard there as a very stable employer, and you had Oregon State University. And you could pick almost any month in the last 20 years, and Benton County had the lowest or the second lowest unemployment rate. It's kind of a medium-sized county with some real stability on top of all the other normal jobs. So I don't know if you have any insights to Washington.
No.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Well, we all know that Washington has a rather vigorous defense establishment. Defense industry is big in Washington. It's almost non-existent in Oregon. And even when the economy goes down, it seems like we keep spending a lot of money on wars anyway. And so it seems to me that would be a stability factor for Washington's economy that Oregon doesn't have.
Madam Chair and Senator Monroe, it's a great point. That would be a third one. And we'll see where that goes in the next few years, as even defense spending may take some hits. But in the last 10, certainly that's true.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for such a thoughtful presentation. And also, I was impressed that you remembered the questions that we asked you the last time we had you here, and you actually came back and tried to answer them.
Well, thanks very much for
inviting
us.
Great. Thank you both. So I think that brings us to the last portion of our agenda, which is a presentation from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I see Kate Newhall in the room and Amy Clare. And it looks like we have you both on the agenda. So if you'd like to come forward together, that would be great. Do we need to take a break, Senator Monroe? We can, but I think we're on track to finish a little bit early if we keep going. So welcome back to the Senate Commerce and Workforce Development Committee. And we actually asked Bully to comment on a number of things. They weren't all listed, but I think in front of you, Senator Monroe, is an agenda that includes several different items. And I think all of those are going to be timely and interesting. So if you want to just go in whichever order you had agreed to go, that would be great.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum and representatives of the committee. My name is Amy Clare. I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I am a native Oregonian.
Yay!
I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Just to give you a brief overview of the implementation of Senate Bill 1045, which prohibits the use of credit histories for employment purposes, with some very notable exceptions. Chair Rosenbaum's chief sponsor of the bill, so you have intimate knowledge of this legislation. It was rapidly passed through the February special session. It passed the Senate on the 15th of February and the House on the 22nd. However, the governor didn't sign the legislation until March 29th. So we were on a rapid timeline to get rules drafted prior to the effective date of July 1. So in the pendency of when we were wondering whether or not the governor was going to sign the legislation, Commissioner Avakian, and I believe Kate Newhall was with him, and you may be able to speak better, did seek input from the interested parties, both the proponents of the legislation, advocates, labor groups, and also business organizations that had some trepidation about this legislation to seek input prior to our rulemaking. So we had some pretty good input prior to establishing our proposed rules. The proposed rules were drafted in the first week of, completed in the first week of April and mailed out to interested parties. And then we held a hearing on May 3rd, which was attended by Senator Rosenbaum and others. And although there were maybe 10 to 12 people that attended, we received comments probably from about 40 individuals, and they were very substantive, and they actually resulted in some significant changes to the rules and the final rules. The final rules are what appear before you today, and those were in effect on June 1, and then they were in place for a month prior to the effective date of July 1, and then on July 1, our technical assistance unit, which is separate from the Civil Rights Division, it's the Technical Assistance for Employers Unit, provided free training for employers who were interested in learning more about this legislation. And we had two successive sessions on July 1st, attended by well over 200 people. We had great comments, great discussions. So I'm going to slip over into page 5 of your handout. But you should read through the first parts because it's a plug for technical assistance unit. But I'm trying to get to the meat of this. So Boley was charged with really kind of fleshing out some of the terms that were in the legislation that really could be interpreted one way or the other. So the first part was, well, I got to go into when we signed it into law. But the purpose of this legislation was, it was determined that applicants for employment and employees have a right to privacy in their credit history information, and that their poor credit does not necessarily mean an employer or applicant, employee or applicant, is untrustworthy. And then what is credit history information? It's any communication of information by a consumer reporting agency that bears a consumer's credit worthiness, credit standing, or credit capacity. And what is prohibited? An employer may not obtain or use an applicant's or employee's credit history information for employment purposes. And then we went actually to the Webster's Third International Dictionary for the definition of obtain, which means to gain possession of something by planned action. Use means to be put into action or service. What else is prohibited? It's an unlawful employment practice to refuse to hire, discharge, demote, suspend, retaliate, or otherwise discriminate against an applicant or employee with regard to promotion, compensation, or the terms and conditions of employment based upon such person's credit history. Then here are some of the exemptions in Senate Bill 1045. Federally insured banks and credit unions, employers required by state or federal law to use individual credit history for employment purposes, employers of a public safety officer who is part of a law enforcement unit, is commissioned by a particular government entity, and is responsible for enforcing criminal laws or airport security. And I missed one. And I'm missing a page. And some other, it's law enforcement, okay. Oh, and employers who first disclose to the applicant or employee in writing the reasons for using the information and who are able to demonstrate that it is substantially job-related. And that was our next big task, was defining what is substantially job-related. The test was to evaluate the position to determine, one, if the essential job function includes access to financial information that is required in beyond what's in a normal retail transaction. Two, if the position requires a credit history as a condition of obtaining insurance or a surety or fidelity bond. And this is where, in our training, we got into a lot of discussion. Someone asked, would firefighters be included in the exemptions? And after some discussion, we believe that they would not, because it's not an essential function of a firefighter's job to obtain financial information. They may be exposed to it when they're going through a house, but it's not an essential function of their job. The same with retail employees who do routine cash transactions, such as a cashier. However, retail employees who offer credit terms might be included within the exceptions. And then there were questions about court clerks who take financial and other confidential information. We don't have definitive answers for each of these, but each type, if we were to receive a case, we'd do a case-by-case analysis. And then there are other alternatives to credit history that are still lawful to obtain. Criminal background checks are with notice and authorization are still allowed. Reference checks with authorization and release. And polygraph examinations are exempt. They're not allowed. They're unlawful. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. We have received one case.
That's what I was going to ask.
And we just, I can talk about I can't talk about the substantive part of the case, but I can tell you what it's about. We received a complaint on August 23rd. The complainant worked for a business in Eugene, and it was taken over by another company, and that company required all employees to reapply for their jobs, and as a condition of reapplying for their jobs, they had to submit to a credit check. And that employee was told that there were some bad negative items on her credit report and that she would not be rehired. So she filed a claim with us, and that is in its first month of investigation.
So... thank you. I guess my other question would be, you know, I think you did a lot of outreach to employers to make them aware that the rules were proposed, and then you did those trainings for employers so that they would know what the rules said and what they meant. How are employees, do you think, how well aware are they that this law now is on the books in Oregon? That is, I think, always a concern, because we don't really do that kind of outreach to the workforce that we obviously want to train employers so they don't run afoul of the law unnecessarily.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's an excellent question. We are fortunate that our partners and the advocates for the bill have been getting the word out. Our communications director, Bob Esterbrook, has also been doing, you know, blast communications, and also we're participating in community forums whenever we can. Next week we're participating with the Urban League of Oregon or Portland in a community outreach forum, and we're going to be talking about employment and housing issues, also wage and hour issues, so we'll definitely bring this up in that forum as well.
Senator Telfer, we just have launched into the Bureau of Labor and Industries presentation, and they just did an overview of the implementation of Senate Bill 1045, which was the bill that limited the use of personal credit history for employment purposes. So we're now in the Q&A portion on that topic, and that's pretty much where we are. Any other questions about this topic? Okay, thank you very much. And I obviously it's a new law, so we hope that you will keep us surprised as you move forward. If it turns out there are things that need to be tweaked or adjusted, I'm sure we'll hear about it. And we hope from you, but also from employers, from the credit bureaus, and from affected employees. So
definitely. Thank you.
Great. So I think the next topic, we have several other topics to talk about, and so you may have prepared them in a certain order.
In any order?
They're on our list as interns, temporary employment, wage claims, and then other issues.
That's pretty much the order. So for the record, Kate Newhall, Legislative Director at the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I'm here today to give an update on emerging issues in wage and hour law. As you all know, our wage and hour division works to enforce compliance with the state's laws relating to wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment. This includes our wage and hour laws governing minimum wage, overtime, meal and rest periods, and the state's prevailing wage law. The division also certifies the employment of minors and our farm forest labor contractors. The two issues in wage and hour law that I'd like to discuss with you today relate to, number one, interns in the workplace, and number two, joint employment liability, the kind that might exist at a temporary agency when they are placing workers in a business. Likely, these are two issues that are surfacing as a result of our struggling economy, unfortunately, but I thought it would be a good opportunity to discuss with you today just some of the basics about the issues related to internships and joint employment liability. So first, I'm going to start just a little with interns. This is an issue that has been generating a lot of increasing interest in inquiries to our office, also in media attention, I suspect because there is an increasing use of interns in the workplace. It hasn't at this point actually generated an increase in complaints to our agency about interns in the workplace, but it has generated inquiries and people asking about it and news stories happening. So, like I said, I think sometimes the complaints coming in are a little bit slower behind the trend, and we see them a little bit later. But like I said, I thought it might be a good opportunity to just go through what the appropriate use of interns in the workplace are. I know we use them at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. When I've worked in the legislature, we use them a lot, too. So, and actually, the Bureau uses the test out of the Fair Labor Standards Act, out of the federal regulations, and they actually have a 6-point test that has to be met for any intern or trainee to be a bona fide qualified internship and not to be in an employment relationship. And so that test is actually pretty stringent. I always find myself coming back to it and checking it. But the first one is that the training that is given to the intern or trainee is similar to the training that would be given in a vocational school. For me, one of the tests that I always use is I want to make sure that my interns are in legitimate school programs, they're getting school credit for it, and they have a criteria and a curriculum that goes along with that. Number two, that the training is for the benefit of the trainees and or the student. And I think that one essentially says it's not for the benefit of the location where that intern is working. The training is for the benefit of the student. Number three, that the interns or students do not displace regular employees, but that rather they work under the close supervision of those employees. Number four, that the employer derives no immediate advantage from the activities of the trainees or the students. And in fact, and the Fair Labor Standards Act actually goes to spell this out, that in some cases, the employer's operation may actually be impeded by having an intern in the workplace. Number five, the trainees or students are not necessarily entitled to a job at the end of the training. They could be, but it's not a stipulation of the internship that they would get a job at the end of it. And the last one is the employer and the intern understands that they are not entitled to any wages for the time spent in training. So I think there's one way to look at your interns and see if it's a legitimate internship is to apply that 6-part test. There's also sort of the flip side, which you could say an intern would be in an employment relationship with the employer if, and this is sort of a 4-part test that we elaborate in our Q&A for employers, if the intern is providing some sort of essential service to the employer, probably an employment relationship there. If the intern is working in a position where someone is normally paid, so if you have an intern is performing the same job function as a paid employee, chances are that's not a legitimate internship. If there's a history of paying someone to do the same or similar work, chances are that's an employment relationship. And if other people are currently paid for the same or similar work. So the last piece that I guess I would say on this, and I handed it out as a handout, we put together a fact sheet that we use for employers that kind of define all of these tests. I also included on there is a state human resources policy that state agencies use when looking at interns or trainees. Also very similar test here, but it's the I think the policy that DAS puts forward for state agencies who might be looking at having interns. Let's see. I think the last thing I was going to say on this, the one thing that we do see is I think often when we do see complaints, it comes up in the employer sort of just calling it an internship and then having those regular duties exist and be assigned. Just because something is called an internship doesn't really have any bearing on what type of analysis we or the U.S. Department of Labor would do on that internship. We would actually be looking at the duties that they were performing and the specifics of that particular situation. So next...
Is that it on interns?
Yes.
Should we ask questions about interns and then before you move on? So... it sounds to me like interns generally have to be students in some educational program.
They don't have, Madam Chair, members of the committee, they don't have to be specifically in an educational program, but the employer has to make sure that they have a set curriculum and training that goes with it. And so because I have the good Christy Hammond, who is our administrator of the Wage and Hour Division, always looking over my shoulder with my interns, it's one of the easiest ways to make sure that you have that criteria met. And so I think it's probably my own cautious nature that I don't take interns that are not in a school program with that type of curriculum. It's not a set standard in the FLSA.
Well, Kate, I guess where I got that was the first page that you provided in your handout. It's like all of these bullet points seem to be describing the student.
I would say
the most common type of internship.
It is, I think, the most common type of internship, and I think the safest way for an employer to go about having interns in their workplace. I know sometimes Christy Hammond, the administrator of our Wage and Hour Division is asked to review employers' curriculum that they might be doing outside of a school program. And she does do that. And she's looking at things like, is there a curriculum, an advancement, exposure to the type of work that they're, the field that they're wanting to learn more about.
I think that part of the reason this has been such a hot topic lately is because of the economy. Mm-hmm. A lot of positions are being defined as internships for people that are out of school that want to get a job, and in order to get a job, they need experience doing a job. So it seems like the New York Times stories and the ones that have run in the Oregonian, are a lot of them are about that kind of placement situation in an employer who really is bringing people on sometimes for months, mm-hmm. with no compensation, and they're not students. And so I think I wasn't the one that originally got interested in this topic. It was actually one of our colleagues, Senator Jenny Burdick. But it does seem like that's a gray area, but possibly an area where the line is crossed sometimes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that that's absolutely correct and true. And I think if an employer were looking to bring on interns outside of a school program, I would advise them to be extremely cautious and to really be developing a good program curriculum that exposes that intern to real on-the-job training, and to have that criteria and that program laid out in writing, gone through with the intern, potentially even reviewed by our wage and hour division. I think it is a gray area, and that would be a place where I would strongly advise caution to employers looking to take on interns outside of a school program.
Senator Telfer has a question.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a state senator, and I'm sitting here listening to the details and wondering the relevance to my position as a senator. So do we have a problem in this state that needs some legislative fix to it? Do we have enough of these claims of people filing claims that are being interns that should be being paid or something like that? I'm just trying to determine why so much detail.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think one of the reasons that I felt like this was an important issue is we have gotten a lot of inquiries, media attention, interest in the topic at our agency, and it has seemed to me that there is, in those inquiries, some confusion about what the appropriate use of interns is. So, like I said at the beginning, I don't think at this point we have not seen an increase in complaints from interns inappropriately classified, but given, I think, the level of interest that's out there, a feeling that there is an increasing use of interns in the workplace, that it was a good opportunity to come share some of the parameters and the appropriate uses of interns. And I do think sometimes that our complaints trail a little bit behind the inquiries that we see out there.
And actually, I would say the reason there was that much detail is because I asked them to come and do a presentation on the proper use of interns. It may be that there's no problem, but I think there certainly is an increasing use of interns. I'll just give you an example that I have a next-door neighbor who's interning as a cook at a restaurant for no money and hoping to get a job there. And I don't know why that is, and I'm certainly not, suggesting that he should complain about it because he wants to get a job.
So he's not paid.
Right. So, but I think the other thing that jumped out at me at the tail end of your handout, and you didn't talk about it, is that there's this category of volunteers. And it may be for some situations, people should not be called interns, but should be called volunteers. And that test seems to be just that you're doing it freely, you're not being paid, you're doing it for community service, religious or humanitarian reasons, and you're doing it for a public employer or a religious charitable education or nonprofit. That seems like probably it would be better if you wanted to bring people in, for instance, in the legislature and they weren't students, mm-hmm. to call them volunteers.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that's exactly an appropriate and probably better advised course of action. Unfortunately, that's not an opportunity that's open to private businesses. It's limited to state agencies, nonprofits.
Profits. Yeah. Okay, great. Any other questions on interns or volunteers? And then I think there were two more things we were going to talk about.
So the second issue that I was going to talk about is joint employment liability. And this is another one that has been coming up a bit in the news, and I think also as the prevalence of the use of temp agencies increases, another subject that I thought would be good to touch on. Again, in this instance, and looking at joint employment liability, BOLI applies, there's not a specific state statute to this, BOLI applies the standard found in the Fair Labor Standard Act. And joint employment is when you have two employers that essentially have a shared employment relationship with a particular employee. The way that I think this comes up most often are two instances, and I can't actually think of another one, and I couldn't get Christy Hammond to think of another one in prepping for this. But when a temporary agency sends workers out to place them in a business, you potentially have situations where you've got a joint employment relationship. And when farmers and farm labor contractors are working, and I think that's a very similar situation to a temp agency, the farmer and the farm labor contractor may have joint employment responsibility over a particular worker. So when we're looking at this, it is another test that is always specific to the particular case at hand. But essentially, what we're looking to is to see if there are two employers that have direction, have direction and control over a particular employee. So in the situation of and I'm just going to use the temp agency as the example, the temp agency is the one that actually hires and brings on the workers, has the authority to fire them, to discipline them, but then they place that worker in a business. The business also has the authority and ability to discipline the employees, to set the hours of their work, to set the conditions of their working. That is, I think, the classic example of when both employers have a joint employment relationship with that employee. And in that instance, both employers can be liable for wages that are owed to the employee, for penalties, for working conditions. So I think another place where I would advise caution when using temporary workers, that a business also recognize that they could be found to be liable for any wages that might come up or be found to be due to that person.
Civil rights,
too. Oh, and then civil rights. Sorry, the same test applies in civil rights. Yeah. Thanks for reminding me on that, Amy. I'm just so limited in the wage and hour world.
And Senator Monroe, and anyone else that's listening, this topic arose because I'm not sure if you saw the coverage over a situation that happened up in Clackamas County where people were hired to work at a warehouse for a large supermarket chain by a staffing agent company, basically a guy mm-hmm. in California who ran ads, I think on Craigslist, mm-hmm. just said warehouse work, whatever the wage was, and then these people showed up at this warehouse and worked shifts on a regular basis and then just didn't get paid. And when they found that they needed to do something about it and tried to contact the person that had hired them, they got I can't remember what the response was, but basically...
No response.
No response.
Wow. Okay, so, no, I didn't see that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how commonplace that is, but it clearly, I mean, people get hired a lot for temporary jobs right now because there aren't very many permanent jobs, and certainly it's a big problem if the company doing the hiring isn't going to pay you, then you have a problem.
And so the rectification of that situation would be that the people that they did the work for directly would be liable, as well as the person in California, if you can find him.
Yes. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, in that instance, I'm happy to report that the business, actually, we put out a press release about it, we'll commend Safeway publicly, the business where the workers were placed actually stepped up. We didn't do an investigation, but paid all of those workers the wages that they were claiming, totaled about $6,000. And we are currently still pursuing penalty wages against the temporary employment agency. I'm not sure what Safeway plans to do, but they could very well pursue private action against the temporary agency for repayment of the money that they paid.
Is this just a real rare circumstance, do you think, or do you have any idea how widespread
it comes up? It comes up fairly infrequently, but the most common place that it comes up is not actually the temp agencies, it's the farmers and the farm labor contractors.
Right.
And that just might be the nature of our economy. I don't know if we'll see that change, because I do think that there's an increasing use of temp agencies in the last year or two. So.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And just go ahead and complete your presentation if you had anything else.
And I think those were all the things that I was coming today to. Oh, wait, I do have my second handout, the specific one. So one of the things that I was asked to come and talk about are the trends in wage claims that we've been seeing at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. What I have for you on the sheet is just an overview of fiscal year 2010, the statistics from the Wage and Hour Division in terms of the number of wage claims we received, the number of wages collected. In fiscal year 2010, we received just over 2,300 wage claims, and that resulted in about $1.6 million in wages being collected on behalf of workers. That doesn't include the amount of prevailing wage rate wages collected. We sort of put that in a separate category. We collected about $1 million in prevailing wage rate wages owed to workers. The other interesting piece on there is in fiscal year 2010, we paid about $912,000 out of the Wage Security Fund. And as you know, the Wage Security Fund is something unique to Oregon and is a fund that allows for workers to be paid out their final paycheck if the business has gone out of business without the ability to pay workers. When I was getting ready for this testimony and comparing sort of fiscal year 2010 to the previous year, fiscal year 2009, I myself was a little bit surprised to see that we have not seen a bigger increase in the number of wage claims that we're processing at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. So I looked just a little bit farther and looked at what we have seen beginning of fiscal year 2011. So keep in mind that fiscal year 2011, we're only 2 months into it, and I can only tell you about July and August so far, but in the first 2 months of fiscal year 2011, we've seen a 223% increase in our wages collected for workers. So I don't know that that trend is going to continue, but in the last 2 months, we have certainly seen an increase in the wage claims coming into the Bureau of Labor Industries. And
that started July 1st. Mm-hmm. That's a year starting July 1st.
Yeah.
And other states don't have a security fund?
To my knowledge, Oregon is the only state with a wage security fund.
Wow. Those people are just out of luck, huh?
And we've had it for quite some, I don't have off the top of my head, but we've had it for quite some time. Amy, can you?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, I think when I used to work for the AFL-CIO, I know Irv Fletcher was involved in that, and I think it was prior to my tenure there, which I worked there from 1989 through 1997, so it was even before 1989, probably 1987 or 85.
Way back then, huh? Mm-hmm. I was here.
I know.
I was here too, but I wasn't in the legislature then.
Well, it's interesting that other states haven't copied, because this seems like such a fair and essential provision to have.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
And how is it funded?
It is funded from a slight diversion of unemployment insurance taxes, and it's some fraction of a percent for one quarter of the year that's diverted to the Wage Security Fund. I would be happy to send you guys
but
all these after that.
But it comes from UI taxes that employers
right.
pay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And do we still try to collect that money?
Absolutely,
back?
We do.
Yeah.
If Madam Chair, members of the committee, if the Wage Security Fund pays out on behalf of an employer, we aggressively pursue back payment to the Wage Security Fund if that employer comes back into business or has assets. We do. Normally my wage and hour statistics sheets includes a little stat on monies recovered for payback to the Wage Security Fund. I can get that for you. Christy's always proud of that one, too.
Yep.
So.
Great. Okay, well, thank you very much. Sorry to make you wait till the last part of our agenda today, but we're really pleased that you have so much information and keep up the good work. Okay, well, I do not have anything further on our agenda today. You do have your flashcard there. That's the testimony that we got earlier today from...
I think I'll leave that.
Okay, that's fine.
Dr. Michaels. Okay, well, with nothing further to come before us, Teresa, did you have any comments about bill introduction deadlines?
Well, Madam Chair, I think, as I say, in the Senate, as you may know, it's still officially not up in the air, as to the official date, but I believe informally it is still next Monday, the 27th. So, and that's for both the committee bills and for individual member bill requests to be submitted to Legislative Council.
Committee bill requests?
Yes, that's also on the 27th as well.
And then committee bill introductions.
The introductions themselves will take place at our hearing on December. I believe we're on the 15th, the 15th or the 16th.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you very much. And members, we are adjourned.